Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is Big Books and Bold Ideas, the show where readers meet writers, and it's good to have you listening. April is Animal Month on this show. We're broadcasting interviews about what wolves reveal about human fear, the science of how a puppy becomes a dog, and much, much more. If you miss any of these shows, you can always find them on my podcast. Today, it's not dogs or monkeys or bats, but bees and beetles and butterflies. It may not seem like it on a summer evening in Minnesota when the mosquitoes are feasting on your skin, but our kingdom of insects is diminishing so quickly that scientists have declared it a crisis. Journalist Oliver Millman writes in his new book, "Insects are the most accessible animals in our lives beyond our cats and dogs, but they're also the most otherworldly and arguably most impressively tenacious beings we share this planet with." Mr. Millman is the environmental correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian, and his new book is titled The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. And he joins us from New York City. Oliver, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be with you, Carrie. Hi.
I thought that word otherworldly was interesting. Tell me what you, I sense there's a lot of dimension to that. Tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah, there is. And even people who study insects, entomologists, will remark upon this when they look at insects, especially closely. There was one scientist I spoke to for the book who had spent 20 years trying to find ways to wipe out mosquitoes through means of genetic modification. But one day she had this epiphany looking at a mosquito underneath a microscope and saw its, huge kind of compound eyes, its kind of translucent wings, all the different kind of colors to it. It kind of looked like an alien to her, but in a kind of very beautiful sense. And it kind of changed her perspective on the creatures she was supposedly trying to wipe out. And she took a different direction with her research to try and maybe do different things to avoid the spread of disease caused by mosquitoes without killing them off entirely. So they are otherworldly. They have incredible abilities. I kind of found out so many kind of interesting things about what bees and beetles and butterflies can do. Which are quite amazing. I mean, these are kind of incredible feats of kind of strength, endurance, logistical abilities. Bees can be taught to play soccer. You have these tiny little monarch butterflies that can migrate thousands of miles to the same spot every year. I mean, it's kind of quite amazing to think about what they're able to do, considering they're small, kind of these small kind of buzzy things that we don't think about that often. So they're kind of these kind of aliens on Earth, and yet they're also the most kind of common and annoyingly so sometimes to us. They seem to be around us all at the same time. So there is that kind of slight dichotomy in terms of our relationship with insects and how we see them.
Yeah, you've just touched on something that I wanted to talk about, which is I think beyond our dawning appreciation for pollinators and the essential work that they do, many of us have grown accustomed to thinking about insects as, as things we want to avoid or solve or, just live without the presence of. I mean, as I was reading your book, I was thinking, and that section about mosquitoes, I was thinking, I now plan an annual trip up to the Boundary Waters, these wild lands between Minnesota and Canada, around the hatch of mosquitoes, because they're so bloodthirsty up there and so ubiquitous. I just don't want to be anywhere near them, without the protection of a building to be in. And yet your book gave me a kind of a different lens to look through than their pests, get rid of them. And I'd like to know how you kind of wrestled with, this ambivalence that humans seem to have about insects, and then your appreciation as you research the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic question. I think that gets to the heart of the book and the heart of this issue. So for me, it started with this kind of scientific question, seeing all these kind of pieces of research, all these studies from around the world showing these kind of catastrophic declines of insects, and kind of trying to figure out as a kind of environmental science journalist what that means, you know, how to kind of explain that to the public in an accessible kind of way. But it kind of touched, then I realized, on a kind of deeper question, which was our relationship with insects and how we view them. And you're right, we do often see them as pests. I mean, we call them creepy crawlies. We say people are bugging us if they're annoying us. I mean, we have a whole set of language, don't we, around insects. It's quite rude. We don't have many fond terms for insects at all. We tend to not think of them, and when we do think of them, we often think of them as things we don't really want to have around. But I think that is playing into this crisis we are seeing, unfortunately. It is leaving us ill-equipped to deal with the insect crisis, because life on Earth is so fundamentally driven by insect life, and the things that we rely upon, the food we eat, the ecosystem services we all need to survive, hinge on large part on insects. To lose them is to lose creatures that are far more important to us than, in a kind of selfish utilitarian way, than any other creature on Earth, really. You know, as much as we want to save tigers and rhinos, and we should do, and it would be a great crime for them to become extinct, elephants as well, we would not really notice their absence in a day-to-day sense. You lose bees, you lose flies, you lose beetles, mass starvation breaks out. You start seeing the collapse of forests and grasslands, and you know, you start seeing feces and dead bodies pile up everywhere. I mean, it's a very kind of visceral, terrible thing that would happen. So I wanted to kind of illustrate that importance and try and give another dimension to our relationship with insects, because it is a little bit more complicated than just wanting to swat that mosquito or fly that's nearby you.
You quote a biologist that I've interviewed named Dave Goulson, Goulson, yep. And he says to you, most of life on Earth would disappear if we didn't have insects. And if there were any humans left, they wouldn't be having much fun. Is that just all about food production, or is it far beyond that? What does he mean?
Yeah, it is primarily around food. The great biologist D.O. Wilson, who passed away last year, he kind of put it at about three or four months we would survive in a world without insects. It is a lot of it is down to food production. So if you think about the food we eat, around, you know, three quarters of the world's crops are pollinated by insects. We would lose a lot of the kind of nutritious, valuable foods on our plates, a lot of the fruits, a lot of the vegetables. So you're already seeing, unfortunately, cases of premature deaths and malnutrition around the world due to pollinator loss, because we're already seeing this kind of loss of pollinators. So we're already getting kind of glimpse of what that would look like. But if all of them were to disappear, then we would just be reliant on wind pollinated crops, you know, wheat and oats and rice and so on. That obviously would not be sufficient for many people. But you see more kind of fundamental breakdown. You see a kind of breakdown in food webs and the food chains. So, you know, you may not like insects, but you may well like birds. You know, there's lots of insect eating birds that would perish and are already suffering declines in some parts of the world because they don't have enough insects to eat. So you go up through the food chain, you start taking out amphibians as well as birds. You start taking out other creatures that feed upon those creatures, and you end up going all the way up the food chain to us. So it would completely destabilize life as we would know it. We would see, as I was saying before, the collapse of kind of ecosystems, of forests, of that kind of thing. It would be a very, very grim place. It's not a place we would want to be in. And I don't think we're going to get there. I think insects are going to outlive us on this earth, but we don't want to push ourselves into the conditions where we get anything close to that.
Hey, where in the world, by the way, would you say the insect crisis is at its most severe? And that maybe that is a, you know, the canary in the coal mine for other places in the world that are seeing a diminishment of insects. Where should we look to say we don't want to get anywhere close to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the really interesting things with this, the declines we're seeing here, because I think in other fields of, you know, environmental research and environmental problems, we see, you know, the melting ice caps or, you know, these deforestation in the Amazon, these kind of wild places, remote places that are in trouble and being degraded horribly. But with the insect crisis, it's here. It's around us. It's in our backyards. I mean, some of the studies have been taken in places you would think would be quite kind of stable, kind of insect-friendly places. One of the big ones was this study that came out in Germany 2017. It found that the annual average weight of flying insects caught in traps in nature reserves in Germany, not in farmland or not in cities or next to highways, but actually in nature reserves, had fallen by 76% since 1989. So since the fall of the Berlin Wall, Germany has lost three quarters of its flying insects by weight in its protected areas. I mean, this is not a country you would think is, you know, backwards in ways when it comes to, you know, nature preservation or the understanding of the importance of wildlife. Denmark, there's this incredible study where this guy started driving his old beat up Ford Anglia car up and down the same stretch of road in Denmark to count the amount of bugs that splattered on the windshield. And he's been doing that every summer since 1997. And he's found a 97% decrease in a very quiet kind of rural area of Denmark. It's not somewhere you would think would be, you know, horrendous for wildlife. In the US as well, I mean, we're seeing huge declines of bumblebees in kind of parts of the US West where you would think they would have very nice, stable kind of place to live. Ohio is losing 2% of its butterflies a year. I mean, the list goes on and on. There's this really lovely protected forest in New Hampshire, 83% decline in abundance of beetles since the 1970s. So it's not these kind of frontline kind of environmental war places that you think of, where, you know, some kind of industrial machinery has come in to kind of tear things up. Although that is obviously a huge problem with the insect declines, but it's kind of everywhere. It's protected places. It's our gardens. It's our forests. It's kind of pretty much everywhere that we are looking so far. And we haven't looked everywhere. We don't know much about what's happening in the tropics, for example, which is where, you know, most insect life lives. But the glimpses we do have so far, you know, are quite shocking.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to Big Books and Bold Ideas, and it's Animal Month. April is Animal Month on the show. And we're in conversation this hour with Oliver Millman. He's the environmental correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian, and his new book is titled The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. We've started out getting an overall picture of why and where insects are declining and what they mean in a general sense to the food chain. Now we're going to zero into some specific insects, and we're going to talk about some of the reasons that we're seeing such a sharp decline in insect populations. And Oliver, I want to talk about chemicals, because climate change is clearly altering the habitats of insects, and we'll talk about that. But it's clear from your book that chemicals are a scourge to insects, and we live in an agricultural part of the country. You write about what you call the circular addiction that farmers find themselves in with chemicals. What is that? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people's ideas of farming is still around the idea of a kind of family farm, which is quite diverse. You know, you have an apple orchard over there, maybe some crops over there, you have some pigs and chickens running around. In reality, of course, it's far more ordered, monocultural, we have, and larger and industrialized. So essentially, the US Midwest, as well as areas like the Central Valley in California, essentially become a factory floor of farming. So we have this, these huge kind of plains with planted with just single crops, usually soy or wheat or something like that. And at the margins, everything has been cleared. So there's no weeds, nothing like that. It's all about kind of maximizing the profit that comes from the land, which is, you know, understandable. For an insect, though, that's a kind of death sentence, that it's a desert in terms of food. There's nothing, there's no refuge there for them to live or to feed. And what makes it worse is that this land has been doused in chemicals. And the chemicals used on US farmland are some of the most potent in the world. The European Union, for example, has phased out the use of some of the worst kinds of neonicotinoids, which is this class of pesticide that sends insects mad or kills them very, very effectively and indiscriminately. But these neonics, as they're called, are spread liberally across US farmlands. By one measure, the farmland is 48 times more toxic than it was 25 years ago across the US West, because there's this continual layering of pesticides that seeps into the soils, seeps in throughout the plants, picked up by bees and pollen, gets into waterways, so it affects aquatic insects and other animals. It's even being picked up by the birds as they eat the insects and the food too. So there is this circular addiction, as you say, because the farmers are being promised that this is the only way that they're going to make money off their land, because this is the only way to banish pests. And so they are sold the seeds already coated in these neonics a lot of the time. There isn't much choice for them. They have to kind of go along with this. I'm not blaming farmers for this at all. It's more about big ag, I think, pushing these chemicals upon farmers. And I think the sadness is, beyond the huge loss of life of insects, which harms us all, is that it's often not necessary. I mean, there's plenty of research now showing farming yields do fine without applying all these chemicals, and sometimes can be harmed by them. So we're creating this huge kind of toxic legacy that is unnecessary, but it does well for big ag. So we're kind of locked into it for now.
I want to linger for a minute on these neonicotinoids, because the University of Minnesota has done some research on discovering it in low levels in our lakes and streams. As you've noted, it's getting into waterways. Both, by the way, both in the agricultural parts of our state, but also near our cities, which is indicating to us that people are using some form of this on their lawns and gardens, right? Is the answer, I mean, when you talk about big ag and addressing this, is the answer, I mean, some kind of EPA regulation? Is it state-by-state legislation? Given the dire effect that this chemical, these chemicals are having,
the EPA is the primary tool there. I mean, the EPA has declined so far under pressure from agricultural lobbyists to not curb the use of neonicotinoids. There are certain rules around the kind of times and the types of application of them. But in terms of actually banning them as a class, the EPA has so far signaled it doesn't want to do that. Obviously, states can move to do that. California has got some rules around this, but states such as Minnesota less so. Neonics, I mean, they should. I mean, the terrible thing about them for me is that there was this, the book Silent Spring by Rachel Carson in the 60s, which kicked off the kind of modern environmental movement, targeted DDT, this chemical that was being kind of sprayed everywhere and causing the loss of bald eagles, among other things, which was, you know, incredibly un-American, of course. And there was this huge kind of movement to ban it. And and that was successful, and they managed to get rid of DDT. Neonics, by one calculation, are about 7,000 times more toxic to bees than DDT. So we've replaced one class of terrible chemicals, which, you know, inspired a whole generation of environmentalists, with another which is 7,000 times worse, and it kind of gets everywhere. The strength of it is it goes throughout the plant that you're trying to protect from pests, so it protects all of it from pests, but that means that it leaches everywhere. So, you know, there's studies showing that it's been found in, you know, spinach and onions and green beans, in even in baby food, in drinking water in the US, in waterways. So it's kind of getting everywhere, and we need to really think seriously about if that's something we want to have as an ongoing legacy.
You have a very vivid description of what a agricultural field may look like to an insect. And so I wanted to read this. You write, "What may look like a benign field of corn to us is to an insect more akin to a home that has been replaced by a fetid pit filled with whirring buzzsaws and famished crocodiles." Can you explain why?
Yes. If you could, forgive the allusion to all those terrible things. But, because essentially you've stripped out what was once a complex kind of ecosystem of grasslands, different wildflowers, you know, maybe a stream, maybe a hedgerow, maybe, you know, some trees. Complex is varied, and insects like that. They like kind of variety of life. That's why you saw during the pandemic, when we started to kind of cut beside the highways less and kind of backed off cities, and people stayed indoors a bit, and things were allowed to grow, weeds were allowed to grow. You saw this kind of explosion of life, didn't you? And that was kind of triggered in part by, because the insects kind of came back. So insects like disorder and jumble. We like kind of order and tidiness, and to us that means cutting down our lawns and cutting down all the farmable land down to its bare components, so we can plant what is the most profitable crop, which is usually soy or corn or whatever it may be. And so for insects, unfortunately, they've lost that complex ecosystem that sustains them. And what they're left with is a single plant. And one scientist said to me, it's like all you're offered to eat is chips, nothing but chips. Even if you don't like chips, that's what you've got. You've got chips. Mm. You don't eat them. You aren't able to eat them. It doesn't matter. That's what you've got. And so for a lot of insects, that's obviously not sustainable. They also have nowhere to live because of the weeds, like I was saying, have been cut near the borders of the field. So there's not even a kind of refuge at the fringes for them. And there's these terrible toxic chemicals that have been laid in on top of them. So it's an extremely perilous place for insects. There's a lot of people who would tell you that, you know, people's backyards are probably, you know, or even like places in cities are, you know, at the margins of railway tracks or beside highways or something, a better habitat for insects than farmland, because they at least provide some of these things that insects miss out on when they're over agricultural areas.
You know, I was reading not too long ago about some of the work that the Bee Lab at the University of Minnesota is doing, and one of the projects that they've undertaken is breeding bees that are resistant to mites and bacterial disease. You have some great writing in the book about what has happened following colony collapse. I think most of our listeners are familiar with that. Where are we in the arc of understanding what happened? And then starting to protect bees from that, if that's even possible. So where do things stand?
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of cast your mind back kind of probably about 15 years ago now, there was this huge, kind of huge panic that we would just lose all bees because of colony collapse disorder. And you can see why, because it was kind of like a seemingly inexplicable disappearance of them, like the Mary Celeste, the ship that was found without its crew on board. Like the bees were just not there anymore, and the beekeepers were stunned to see this. And we still have not got a definitive answer on this, although there are some very strong suspects which are linked to the causes of the broader decline of insects. So it's not an existential threat to bees anymore, the colony collapse. It's not something that's the kind of primary driver of loss, but it certainly helped raise awareness, I think. Got it on the cover of Time magazine, didn't it? It kind of got the issue of bees and Save the Bees, and bees being this kind of avatar, the kind of symbol of insects and insect declines. So whenever you have a kind of rally, a kind of public protest around saving insects, I mean, they do exist, these protests, you'll usually have people dressed as honeybees, or, you know, have pictures of bees, right? Because bees are the ones that, yeah, they're the symbol. They're the kind of standard bearer for
insects. Kind of like the polar bear with climate change. Right. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's our kind of most accessible point. People kind of understand and like bees. We don't like being stung by them, but we kind of appreciate what they do for us. And when we think of bees, most of us think of honeybees, of course, which are the managed bees in hives. We don't really think of the wild bees as much. But they're the ones that have become the kind of symbols of insect decline. So it was useful in that respect of getting it on the agenda. In terms of causes, though, we're still left with the probable causes of that collapse, but on a much grander scale, unfortunately, which are, you know, climate change, habitat loss, and pesticide use.
So as awareness has risen, as the visibility of what's happening with bees has risen, what's happened with the populations?
Yeah, well, there's been some, in the last kind of 5 years or so, there's been this kind of outpouring of research looking at insect declines where previously scientists didn't really bother to look. I mean, what was the point? I mean, insects are everywhere. Why would you count them? It seemed kind of pointless to do, but they started to do this around 2017 when that study came out, which I mentioned, in Germany, showing those huge declines, they're now, these declines are pretty much everywhere you look. I mean, there was the huge decline in Denmark I mentioned, in the rainforest of Puerto Rico. This scientist Brad Lister, who's from upstate New York, He visited the rainforest there in the 1970s and conducted these studies where he had these plates with sticky substances on them, which kind of trapped insects in them, and he counted them in the morning. And he went back there just a couple of years ago, and these sticky plates, he recreated the experiment. The sticky plates were actually clear. There was nothing there on them. And he was astonished. And there was 98% of insects by biomass had gone since the 70s, again, a protected area, it's one of the only rainforests in on U.S. territory in Puerto Rico. These insects have virtually disappeared since the 70s. You're seeing insects disappear in France, in Germany. 50% of British butterflies have gone over the last 50 years. In Australia, you're seeing declines too of beetles, of particular butterflies, of bees. The declines are kind of astonishing, really, if you think about the scale of them. I mean, I kind of tend to think of it in comparison to the animals we all think about when we think about conservation, such as, you know, tigers or lions or elephants. I mean, we've lost kind of 95% of the world's tigers, I think it would be safe to say. But that's over the course of 100, 150 years of kind of hunting habitat loss. We've lost the same order of magnitude of insects just since the kind of the 80s or the 90s. I mean, it's quite incredible the time span at which this has all happened. It's really accelerated in the last kind of 20, 30 years or so, unfortunately for them. So we're kind of only we're kind of really playing catch up still with what that means.
You're listening to a conversation with Oliver Millman as part of Animal Month on Big Books and Bold Ideas. His new book is titled The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Rule the World. Oliver, before we move off of bees, we really have to talk about these bee brokers. I'd read about them, I think, in, you know, like in daily journalism, but your book goes into even deeper insight into how these brokers work. And I had no idea that, you know, they pack up these bees and they frantically drive to the next fields and they let the bees do the work and then they pack them all up. I mean, I would think these bee brokers are going to become ever more valuable and in demand, especially for, you know, crops like the almond crops in California. Tell me a little bit about their work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same as you. I went to the Central Valley in California and met this bee broker, and I had no idea such a job exists. this lady called Denise, and her job is essentially to match beekeepers with their hives of honeybees with farmers who need their crops pollinated in Central Valley in California. A lot of that is almonds. So each year she kind of acts as a kind of matchmaker, matching up the two. And this job is so lucrative for her now that she only works for, you know, a couple of months a year. And then she spends the rest of the time playing golf. So she managed to kind of live off this as a job, which is kind of incredible. But also it's incredible because we're using small kind of buzzy insects that can sting us as contracted agricultural workers,
right?
Unpaid for them, of course. And we put them into hives and strap them onto trucks and then move them around the country to pollinate citrus down in Florida or blueberries up in Washington State or almonds in California. So every managed hive in Minnesota, much just like every other state, will go to around the country to do this work because it's becoming more and more valuable. It's becoming more valuable financially. Because the wild bees are being killed off due to us killing them off through the way we're doing things. And also because the food production needs are now so dependent on honeybees and growing that we kind of need to continually keep their numbers up, even as they're assailed by disease and other effects. So there's this constant kind of treadmill to try and desperately keep up with the system we've created for ourselves. And it was quite incredible to see in real life.
I want you to describe what you saw, but here's my question. Is it then the case that a lot of this used to be done by wild bees? And as you've said, the numbers have declined precipitously. And so these bee owners, beehive owners, are cultivating bees for this work. I mean, a lot of this is not just happening naturally anymore. This is all kind of on a wheel of production, and the beehive owners are a big part of that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So this idea that beekeepers are just these hobbyists, you know, that just have a couple of hives out the back and you get some nice honey for your toast. I mean, that is still the case in some respects, but a lot of beekeepers now are essentially, you know, contracted workers who have an asset that is of use to the agricultural industry. And the agricultural industry is so dependent upon that asset because through the clearing of fields for a single crop, because of the use of the pesticides, they've wiped out all the natural wild pollinators around their crop. So they've created the demand for themselves, if you see what I mean. And so if you have a huge expanse of almonds in California, you've killed off a lot of the wild bees. There's not enough bees around to pollinate your crop, so you need to get in bees from elsewhere. So you will contract a beekeeper to come with a truck laden with hives of bees, and set the hives down next to your crop and pollinate it, and you can sell your almonds. But the pollination supply is becoming so overstretched now, because even the honeybees are affected by these, the same thing. They're affected by disease, they're affected by climate change, pesticide uses. So it's a kind of very short-term fix. So it's becoming harder and harder to match the demand of pollination through this method. And it's also very vulnerable to a single shock. You know, you depend on one creature for your food supply. What happens if there's a disease that wipes out half of them? Mm. You're in huge trouble. And I mean, it's led to these extraordinary developments. I mean, you mentioned bee brokers. Another thing I found when I was there, they're bee rustlers, thieves that will steal the bees off trucks. And there's a dedicated bee detective with the wonderful name of Rowdy Freeman, who goes around trying to track down these thieves who've taken the bees at the dead of night in these heists. Because the pollination has become so valuable, they can resell them onto other farmers because they're all desperate for pollination. So it's created this kind of really strange, warped, circular addiction that is not natural in any way. There's no part of that that is natural beyond the actual pollination itself, I suppose. But it's a kind of a real subversion of how the system would look in a kind of natural sense.
You know, I thought what you wrote about how insects are adapting was really interesting, because I think when we think of a crisis, you know, and we see, as you've talked about, other species disappearing, we think, well, that's the end of it. There's nowhere to go. But you have been, it looks like, reporting on some research about how some insects are going to adapt to climate change and diminishing habitat. And I guess what I wondered about that was whether it's too soon to really understand how insects are going to weather what we're experiencing, or do you have some examples of that that gives you a sign of how they'll endure? Because I think at the beginning of our conversation, you said insects will outlive us on the planet.
Mm. Yes. Well, I mean, they have the advantage, of course, of sheer numbers and diversity. So there's about 1 million named species of insect. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. There's probably 5 million, 10 million, 50 million. We don't know, because there aren't enough scientists, enough time in the world to count them and find them all. So, I mean, I kind of made the comparison in the book that there's this one class of assassin flies that go around kind of sucking the brains out of other flies, and just that type of fly has more species in it than all the mammals in the world. There's about 5,000 types of mammals in the world. There's about 7,000 types of this fly that goes around sucking the brains out of other flies.
So Oliver, people are going to hear this and say, okay, what's the problem then?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean that's the challenge with insects, isn't it? Unfortunately, right. I mean, flies are a really good example, though, of creatures that we generally hate,
yeah,
but are critical to us. I mean, they are one of the biggest pollinators of food. They're the biggest pollinators of food, our food sources, below bees. You know, you might not like flies, but you probably like chocolate, and a fly is the only thing, a little tiny midge, it's the only thing that is able to pollinate the cacao plant to give us chocolate, coffee as well. So, I mean, you can kind of quite easily kind of say you don't like flies, but a world without them would mean no coffee, no chocolate, and dead bodies all over the place because nothing could break it down, and feces all over the place because nothing could break it down. I mean, that's not really a world I think any of us would really want to kind of live in. They're critically important in terms of adaptations. We are seeing some. I mean, I found out, I got really into monarch butterflies, as many people do, because they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. And followed their migration. I went to central Mexico to see where they spend their winter times. They make this epic journey thousands of miles from the US the northeast of the US, the Midwest of the US, down to Mexico and Canada as well. That journey is being threatened due to climate change. And so the ranges of the trees that they rely upon are changing. The ranges of their habitat in the US and Canada are changing. So their journey is becoming longer. And scientists have actually found out their flight muscles are getting bigger and stronger because they have they're almost evolving in real time, which we all do, of course, to cope with these longer journeys. But that's not going to maybe be sufficient. We're already seeing huge declines in their numbers and their range. So there are some adaptations like that that will happen. Some insects will make it through, but unfortunately, they're the ones that we tend to dislike. I mean, it's not that all insects will disappear. It's that we are creating conditions that are ideal for insects we dislike, and we're doing a very good job of killing off the insects we tend to love and value. So, you know, a world that is hotter and wetter and full of more people and more trash is perfect for mosquitoes and cockroaches and bed bugs. It's not perfect for bees and butterflies. And I think we all kind of prefer one over the other.
Can we do a conversation about insects without talking about murder hornets? I don't think we can. I loved your chapter on this. And I want to read a little bit from, before you talk about it, from what you wrote. For weary Americans in the midst of a harrowing coronavirus pandemic that had paralyzed normal life and precipitated mass unemployment, the prospect of murder hornets, a nickname used in Japan for the creatures, advancing across the country was confirmation that 2020 was cursed. Clearly, there was an overreaction about murder hornets. But what did you learn about them, Oliver? And are they still out there?
They are, yes. And
are
I think,
they? Oh, no.
They are. And I think a lot of entomologists got very kind of worried about the use of the word murder because people started being concerned that they were going to be murdered by these hornets. The murdered hornets are not hunting down humans. They're not serial killers. They murder instead bees. They're very adept at chewing the heads off bees. So that is a concern because obviously what we were discussing before, pollination services are becoming stretched. We kind of need all the bees we can get. I think the tale of the murder hornet is one of globalization, of us spreading things around the world to places they've never been before and then seeing the unintended consequences. So these hornets were originally from Asia, and they ended up in Washington State and British Columbia and Canada, and are now set to spread in the US and, well, across North America, I guess. Because we wish, you know, because we ship goods around, because we move things around, because we have soil on our boots that we move from one country to another on an aeroplane. You know, all of these things cause invasive species, as they're called, to move from one place to another, and that can affect local flora and fauna. It can tip the balance towards the invasives that can then spread. So, yeah, I think their tale is an interesting one in terms of their name and the panic, and to be fair, how extremely painful their sting is. I mean, it can actually finish you off.
Have you ever been stung by a murder hornet?
No, I spoke to somebody who was, though, and he said it was the most painful experience of his life. It was like having hot needles stabbed into his arm. It was just horrendous.
Oh my gosh!
And it kind of caused that he got shaky legs from that. Couldn't walk upstairs very easily for a while. But wow. It's unpleasant, but I guess the broader story is about how we are, you know, again, reshaping nature. We're reshaping the natural world in ways that we don't fully understand in terms of consequences.
You know, there's an insect that I would ask, what positive role could a murder hornet actually play in the not just the food chain, but in our ecosystem. I mean, why are they there, and would it matter if we figured out a way to kill them off?
I mean, probably in the US, it would not matter in a kind of broader sense, in a kind of cold-hearted way, if we were to kill them all off, because they're an imported species. I mean, they are part of a broader tapestry in Asia because they evolved there, and local bees there have a defense against them when they attack.
Wow.
They're not just helpless. Yeah. They kind of cluster around the murder hornet. They'd all jump on, like hundreds of bees jump on the murder hornet and vibrate their wing muscles very rapidly to overheat them, so they cook the murder hornet to death. So they have a kind of like a gang response to them, which bees here in the US don't, because they obviously didn't evolve with them. They don't know what they are. So they do play a role in their native range. They're part of the whole kind of food web. Here, you can make an argument that they don't, and so we could get rid of them. But again, it's us that's moved them here. They didn't hijack a plane and come over to the US. we kind of brought them over. All of these problems are being caused by us. We cannot blame, we can't blame murder hornets for being here. We can't blame, malaria for spreading and dengue spreading from their natural ranges, because the world is getting warmer and therefore the mosquito range is expanding. You know, animals are just, and creatures are responding to the conditions presented in front of them. And we're presenting a range of conditions that are very handy for a lot of things we don't like.
So I thought of you and the work you do as an environmental reporter, when I was reading an interview recently with Robin Wall Kimmerer. You're probably familiar with her.
Yes, that's right.
The author of Braiding Sweetgrass. But unlike many of Robin's other, writings about what's happening environmentally, she was talking about the power of optimism in environmentalism. And she said, so much of what we think about in environmentalism is finger wagging and gloom and doom. But when you look at a lot of those examples where people are taking things into their hands, they're joyful. That's healing, not only for land, but for our culture as well. And it feels good. Kind of a rare beam of light, I think, in an otherwise, pretty dark horizon when it comes to environmental degradation. I was curious, Oliver, about in your daily reporting, how much of that, of perhaps those examples where there is a reason to be optimistic, that you're encountering and writing about?
I mean, I think there is, yeah. I don't want to give the impression that this is all gloom and doom, and I certainly, in the book, I look at some of the kind of solutions to this and some of the movements being made towards making, farming more sustainable, to acting on pesticides. There's obviously a huge movement around acting on the climate crisis. And I've just seen that transformed us in the last, maybe 5 years, perhaps. I mean, before then, I never really thought to speak to somebody who was kind of 18 or 19 about this, but now they're kind of leading a whole revolution in our people's consciousness. The youth climate movement led by Greta Thunberg about climate change, and you're seeing a kind of whole change in the public around attitudes towards this, and we're finally getting some action on that. So there is kind of hope there, although obviously the picture is still pretty bleak in terms of global heating. And similarly with insects, I think there is hope there. I mean, I think people are beginning to understand now how important they are to our lives, that they're not all just annoying pests. They kind of can think that, oh, yeah, I have that kind of recollection that when I was a kid and we drove across country, there were insects splattered on the windshield, and I just don't see that anymore. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of loss. There's a sense that
right.
Something's missing from our kind of everyday lives that should be there. The encouraging thing about insects is they are the great survivors. They survived 5 mass extinctions. The one, they kind of predate the dinosaurs. They outlive the dinosaurs. If we give them a chance to hang on. They will do. We just got to give them, they just got to give them a kind of foothold, a place that where they can survive a little bit of an easier time. And I think they will be okay. And if they're okay, we're going to be okay.
I think part of the challenge is breaking through the noise, Oliver, of, as you've said, the gloom and doom reporting on climate change and everything else in the world there is to worry about. And I know that's a challenge for you in your daily reporting, but also for a book like this. How do you think about how to do that?
Yeah, I mean, we're not short of problems, are we, in the world? And I mean, I wrote this book in the depths of the pandemic, and it was kind of hard to think about ladling another issue on top of people on top of that at the time. But I think the good thing about solving the insect crisis is that all of the solutions to it will help us. It's not just about we have to save the bugs for their own sake, because not many people are going to rally behind that, even though we are, you know, a lot of us are fond of bees and butterflies. But, you know, this is very much a kind of human crisis rather than an insect one. So if we do act on climate change, that's going to obviously benefit us. If we, you know, restore kind of ecosystems, farmland, forests to a more natural state, that's going to be a much greater benefit to us, to places we can enjoy, for cleaner air, for cleaner water, and pesticides. I mean, I think none of us really want pesticides in our food or in our water, just because we want to kill off some aphids that may be munching on some nearby crops. So all of these things can benefit us. I think you can get strong public support behind a lot of those things. It just takes the political will to get it done.
Oliver Millman's book is called The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. Oliver, thank you.
Thank you so much.